Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Frank from Philadelphia.
My name is Frank Spina. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I say that I am recovered today because I no longer suffer from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I'd like to thank you for having me, even though I am a fill-in. I got a call last night from Shay. She said, "You think you can come up here and speak for me?" Of course. After I gave her an earful. No, I'm kidding. Anyway, I'm no stranger to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been around this thing for over 40 years. Okay. And just to let you know that I am where I am today because I probably made every single solitary mistake you can make. Okay. Trudging this road to happy destiny, as they call it. You know. And, I want to share a little bit about my experience, strength, and hope with you people, and hope that maybe something that I can say may help someone here. Anyway, like the gentleman said, I'm from South Philadelphia. I come from a beautiful family. Mom and Dad, neither one of them were alcoholic. I was raised well. I was taught morals. I was taught about God. I was taught responsibility. I never really got in trouble as a kid. Actually, I was a straight A student all the way up until I was 12 years old. Older boy, choir boy, very involved in the Catholic Church at the time. And by all means, I shouldn't be here. I knew right from wrong. I knew better. Okay? I was a nerdy kid. I didn't really fit in with the kids in the neighborhood who were playing sports and stuff like that, you know. And at first it kind of didn't bother me until I started to get picked on all the time. I got bullied a lot, you know. And I always felt like distanced from a lot of the people in my neighborhood. Well, true too is I grew up in an Irish neighborhood, and as you can see, I'm not Irish. Okay, back in the 60s, that was a big thing, especially in the neighborhoods that I come from, you know. You had your Irish neighborhood, you had your Italian neighborhood, you had your black neighborhood. Everybody had their sections that they lived in and they stayed in. And if you were a foreigner, even though I grew up around there and knew everybody, I was still considered a foreigner, you know. I had French parents that I would be hanging with, and they would be with four or five other people. And go to their house, and the father would say, "The Dago's got to stay outside. I don't want him in my house." You know, things like that. Now, naturally, it makes you feel a little bit, you know, not wanted, to say the least, you know. But, like I said, I got bullied a lot. And running back and forth from school every day was a regular occurrence, you know. I mean, I was a skinny little kid, pompadour, greased back hair, you know. The glasses that I wore were exactly the same kind of glasses that I wear today. It's funny. And I ran down the street one day, and there were a bunch of guys who lived in this neighborhood. It was kind of like the melting pot in the neighborhood. These were all the guys that didn't fit in were anywhere. And they just all hung together. And they were probably the baddest gang in the neighborhood. They went where they wanted to go. They did what they wanted to do. You know? And they had a rep. Let's put it that way. And I made the mistake of running down the street where these guys hung. And the one guy jumped off the step. He says, "I see you running every day." He says, "Why do you run?" He said, "Why don't you just turn around and punch that first guy in the face coming around the corner?" And I turned around and I said, "Because I'm afraid, you know?" I mean, fear was definitely no stranger to me back then. I was afraid to get bad grades. I was afraid to get in trouble. I was afraid to do something wrong because I was afraid God was going to punish me. You know, like, see, these are the things that I was taught in school. You screwed up, you're going to get hit with a lightning bolt. God's going to kill you. You're going to suffer the fires of hell forever. And, you know, you're not supposed to do this and you're not supposed to do that and all that. And, you know, I basically from the time I was 6 years old, I was taught, be afraid of God. He's the boogeyman. You know what I mean? And, I tried to live by the way they told me to live. I never lied to my parents. I never did. I never stole anything. You know, I tried to live the way they wanted me to live, basically, because I was afraid. I was afraid. I was afraid of God. I was afraid that I was going to get punished and suffer in hell for the rest of my life. You know. Anyway, back to the story. This guy tells me, he says, I want you to punch the first guy that comes around a corner in the face. And I said, what do you mean? I said, I'm scared to death to do something like that. I'm scared. You know, he turned around and he went like this. He said, well, what are you more scared of? He said, them or us. You know, and he kind of gave me an ultimatum. You know, like, you either punch that first guy in the face or we're going to beat you up. I already got a bunch of guys beating me up. I don't need two, you know? Anyway, it was kind of like one of these things. I shut my eyes, I stuck my hand out like this, and the first guy that came around ran into my fist. You know? And the heart's pumping and the adrenaline's going through me and I'm shaking like a leaf and I don't know what's going on and right. And the kid fell down. All these guys that used to beat me up are sitting there and they're like in awe, like I don't believe that Frank actually hit me, you know? And needless to say, from that day forward, nobody bothered me again. I had a new set of friends that protected me and I felt a little more comfortable in my skin, you know? And the crazy thing about it is when I look back over my life, I never really actually did feel comfortable. It always seemed like I had to always do something to get someone else's approval. You know, I wanted to get straight A's because I wanted everybody, Frank's doing, he's a great kid and this and that and the other. I was an older boy because I can carry the cross down the middle of the church, okay, and get all the attention from all my neighbors. Look how good Frankie is. He's a good boy and all this stuff. You know, I don't want to be no older boy, you know. I mean, I would go to the sacristy and make jelly cookies out of the hosts and stuff like that. I had this mischievous side to me, you know? But in society's eyes, I made sure that I polished that turd. I shined, you know what I mean? I wanted to make sure that everybody thought that I was a certain type of person, you know? Anyway, I start hanging with these guys, the melting pot guys, and you know, they taught me a lot of ways of the street. They taught me how to protect myself. They taught me how to fight. They taught me not to take no stuff off of anybody. You know, and the one thing that they actually taught me how to do was drink. Because they all drank. Almost every night. And I came from a family, there was rarely any alcohol in my house. If there was, like, my dad was the neighborhood number writer. Okay, so he used to take all the horse bets and the football bets and, you know, they used to have like the lottery, but it was a street thing and take numbers and, you know, and all that stuff. And, people used to give him presents at Christmas time, usually, you know, fifths of liquor and stuff. And he didn't drink them. They'd be all sitting in a metal cabinet in my kitchen. You know, I think I was the only family that had aged Seagram 7. You know what I mean? There was like 3 inches of dust on these bottles. I mean, you know. But that's how they were. My mom and dad would have one highball at a wedding and they'd be happy as a clam, dancing their ass off, having a good time. You know? And not drink for 6, 7, 8 months maybe till the next time they went out. You know? And, I was 12 years old when I took my first drink. And I was with a friend of mine, new friend, and, you know, a lot of people say, well, why did you do it? And it was kind of a lot of things, peer pressure. You know, I was curious about the way it would taste, you know, and what it was about and all this different stuff. And Him and I split this bottle of stuff. It was called Italian Swiss Colony Golden Spur. It was, I think it was about 69 cents for the bottle. Okay. We lived near a railroad track, so we had a state store right on around the corner from us. There was a set of railroad tracks that ran down about a block away from us where there were all these factories and stuff, and then the waterfront. And we would get the hobos that lived on, you know, on these trains to go in and get us liquor, you know. So we gave this guy a dollar. He went in and got us this bottle of wine. And we went down underneath. They were just starting to build I-95 through my neighborhood, okay. It was coming down along and through South Philly, and it wasn't finished yet. They had knocked down a bunch of factories, and there were, like, construction vehicles and bulldozers and gravel and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, we would go back there as kids and play in it and stuff like that. But there was a set of steps sitting there where there used to be a factory, and they just left the concrete steps there. The factory was gone. And I'm sitting on the steps. It's about an 85-degree day. It was summertime. And we get this bottle of wine, and I'm looking at it, and it's like, well, you know, don't look that bad. It kind of looked like Boston's grape juice. But then I start looking at it in the light, and it's swirling. It had like this, like, it looked like harbor lights. It was like this purple swirl to it, right? And I'm saying to myself, this stuff don't look too good. You know, and it's, and when he opened it up, it smelled even worse. And when I took my first drink out of it, it tasted even badder. It tasted like somebody left Welch's grape juice out in the sun for about 6 years. Okay? And it was the most horrible, vile stuff that you ever want to put in your body. Okay? But I sat there and I drank it. I drank my share of it. He drank his share of it. Apparently he had done this before because he jumped up and said, yeah, come on, let's go play some basketball. I got off that stool, that step, okay? And I hear people at meetings when they share and the alcohol rose from my feet and it hit my head and I felt this, you know, sense of euphoria about me and all. I didn't feel nothing. That stuff shot from my feet to my head. I totally blacked out, okay? I don't remember nothing that happened for the next 6 or 7 hours, okay? The only thing I actually really did remember from that little bit of time was my father dragging me off of this lady's porch. Because I live, we have row homes where I live, and there's old porch fronts and this and that and the other. And everybody knew everybody, and everybody especially knew my dad. And they knew how to get in touch with him. And my father wasn't a big guy. He was about 5'7", 170 pounds. He was in real good shape, and like I said, my parents never hit me. I never got spanked, I never got hit, never got in trouble. I was a good boy and all this stuff, okay? And I was so drunk, laying on this lady's porch, she called him and told him that your son is messing himself and throwing up at the same time on my porch, that if you don't come around and get him, I'm calling the police. So my dad came around and he was pretty angry and I don't know, I must have said something to him as he was pulling me off the porch because he punched me in the face and broke my nose. Now I'm vomiting, I'm pooping myself and I'm bleeding at the same time. Everything's spinning around and it's a total mess, you know? And I'm saying to myself, why do people like this? You know, like I didn't even like it. I didn't like nothing about it. I didn't like, you know, really anything about it, you know. And he took me home, he threw me in bed, threw a waste paper basket next to me. He said, here, throw up in this, do what you got to do in this, you're not leaving the room, you know. And you know, when I look back at that, the very first time I picked up a drink, I embarrassed my family. Very first time, 12 years old, okay? Very first time I picked up a drink, I got punished. I'd never been punished in my life for doing anything wrong, okay? I had to stay in the house for 2 weeks, couldn't watch TV, had to sit in my room, had to think about what I had done, okay? But I'm going to tell you what I thought about, you know. When I went to Catholic school, we used to have to go to a certain mass on a Sunday. And what they would do is they would, Sister Mary Holy Card would be in the back of the church. And she'd have a list of roll call. And what you would do is you would go in, you tell her you were there. She'd check your name off the list. Okay. And you had to go sit in the pew. You had to, you know, she clicked that little clicker and you stood up and you knelt and did all that stuff, you know. And, at the end of the mass, I'm walking out the back door and all my friends are there. You know, and I'm hungover and I got a black eye from my father punching me in the face and my nose is all swollen up and I'm not very chipper, let's put it that way. And, my one buddy's saying, he said, man, you were out of your mind last night. You should have seen it. You know, the cops rode by, you were mooning the cops and, you know, you were running around and doing all this crazy stuff. And that wasn't me. I never would have did something like that. I would have been scared to death to do something like that. I then wouldn't have the courage to be able to do anything like that. You know? And then my other buddy turned around and goes, yeah, and you were over here, you were talking to so-and-so, and, you know, she's going to the movies with you next Saturday, and you asked her for a date and all that. I'm scared to death of women. I could never look a girl in the face and ask her for a date. You know? I could have never did nothing like that. Okay. But the best one was, is I had a friend of mine, he was like 13 years old, he was 6'4". You know, this kid wound up going to college and becoming this really good basketball player and all this stuff, but he was, you know, he was a big kid. And he's got this black eye and I turned around and I said, well, what happened to you? He said, you happened to me. I said, what do you mean? He says, yeah, he says, I was breaking your stones about you talking to Dolores over there, and you turn around and you punch me in the face. That wasn't me. Okay? You know, and even though I had blacked out, didn't remember anything or whatever, everybody else remembered what I had done. And they told me what I had done. And you know what? That's the guy I always wanted to be. Not to be afraid of anything, to be able to go talk to women, to be able to hang with the guys, to just be loose and do whatever. Alcohol did that for me, even though I didn't even realize it at first. You know? So I did the 2 weeks, sat down with my parents. They read me the riot act about the do's and don'ts of drinking alcohol at my age and all this stuff, and it's not really good for you. Look at your Uncle Duke. I had an uncle who was a hopeless alcoholic, never got sober. He died, you know, drunk. And we used to find him up in a place called Skid Row. They used to have it up in around 8th and Vine. They had all these cheap 25-cent hotels and stuff. And he would go to work all week. He would disappear like Thursday night. And me and my dad, we used to have to go find him one like Sunday morning. He'd be laying behind some dumpster with one shoe. You know, all beat up and drunk and whatever he was doing. And we had to get him and pick him up and take him home. And this was a regular occurrence, you know. And it was one thing I used to say to myself, you know. See, that's what I always thought an alcoholic was. And I used to say to myself, I'll never be like that guy. I'll never be like my Uncle Duke, you know. And I used to always cringe at the thought, you know, when people used to tell me later on, you know, do you think you're an alcoholic? You know, I was like, you know, like put the cross up, like shh. It was like warding Dracula off, you know, like that thought, you know. Mom and Dad sat me down. Like I said, they read me the riot act. I swore up and down and I promised them that I would never take a drink again. You know, and after the experience that I had, you figured that I wouldn't have, you know. But it wasn't the sickness and the vomit and the pooping myself and all that stuff that I remembered. I remembered all the things that it made me. So I thought it made me anyway. It took the fear away. It gave me false courage. Okay. It did something to me that nothing else that I had tried up until that point had done for me. And I chased that feeling for the next 20 some years, you know. And I'm not going to get into my road to destruction, you know. But I know that night that my mother and father let me out, I walked around the corner where my friends were. And they used to play this thing called half ball. We used to get a rubber ball and cut it in half. We'd steal somebody's mop handle and we'd all get together and we'd play half ball behind the recreation center. And one of the things they used to do was they'd get a big metal trash can, they'd fill it with ice, and they used to have these little 8-ounce beers. They looked like kegs, and they were called Peel's Hugs. Okay, and they'd put about 2 or 3 cases of these things in the cold water. Without thinking of the consequences that I had just been through, lying to my parents, getting punished, embarrassing them, all the things that happened from my very first drink, I walked down them steps, walked around the corner, stuck my hand in that cold water, pulled one of them Peel's Hugs out, cracked it open, and started putting them down. Okay? And that night, the alcohol did rise up from my feet, and it closed that big hole inside of me. And I felt like I could conquer the world. I wasn't throwing up and pooping myself on some lady's porch. I was feeling happy, joyous, and free, okay? And there was nothing else in the world that ever took that feeling of fear away from me like that did that night. And I pursued that for the next 20 years. Through alcohol, through a lot of his friends, and I'm going to keep respectable because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but we know what we're talking about. I mean, I grew up in the 60s, you know what I mean? The Summer of Love was happening, Peace Pot and Microdot, Tune In and Turn On, you know? I live 7 blocks from the Spectrum, okay? So every other weekend there was a good concert down there. I saw the Grateful Dead over 300 times. You know what I mean? So it's like, everybody get in, you know, put our money together. We go down there and we would party, you know, beans up at Belmont Plateau. It was a lot of fun. Nobody was getting hurt. Everything was cool, you know. Half of my friends were going away to war because I hung with a bunch of guys that were like 5 years older than me, you know. And, you know, who's going away this week? Who's going away in a couple of weeks? Who's getting chased by the FBI because they were AWOL? You know, and that's just the way it was. You know? And I didn't want to grow up. I wanted to live that life for the rest of my life. I was having a good time. There were no responsibilities involved. You know? But somewhere down the line, I met some poor girl who wound up falling in love with me, and I thought that maybe I might have loved her. I think I liked her most of all because she was kind of like my older ego. I wanted to be like her. You know, she didn't get high. She didn't drink. National Honor Society, you know, a lot of other things. She was just a good kid, you know. And needless to say, I did wind up marrying her, you know, and what I put her through, you know, I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy, believe me, you know. Because, I mean, she was like my caretaker, my mother, my financier, everything. I didn't know what responsibility was. I didn't like responsibility. Responsibility scared me. I didn't want to grow up. I was a drugs arrest kid. I was an alcohol arrest kid, you know. I just wanted to go out there and party all the time. And I would go to work. I had the kind of job where I can go to work and make money and nobody would bother me. You know, I actually worked third shift. And they used to put all of us on third shift, all the drunks and the losers and everything. We were all pretty much related to some big shot in the company. So we couldn't get fired. If they got a little bit of work out of us every night, they were happy. You know, it's the way it was. Yeah. You know? And, you know. But as things started to get a little more like serious in the marriage, like her getting pregnant and, you know, things like that, the fears of being a father, the fears of having to be like responsible, like were overwhelming, you know. The place wound up closing down and I wound up losing this job, and I can remember getting my last paycheck from that place and thinking to myself, what the hell am I going to do now? They're going to hire me. I'm a total mess. How am I going to provide for this family that I'm starting? And how am I supposed to pay my mortgage? And how am I supposed to do this? And how am I supposed to do that? You know? And I just went and got loaded and forgot about it all. See, it was a great, you know, deterrent to responsibility. Let's put it that way. It would just take me out of reality, and you know, I wouldn't even bother worrying about none of this stuff. You know, and also as I started to get into this stuff more and more, it wasn't beer no more. It was hard liquor. You know, I was putting away a fifth a day, along with other stuff, heavier sedatives. Let's put it that way. Okay, we'll call them sedatives. And, you know, it wasn't working like it first worked. My head wasn't shutting off. I just kept running and running and running, you know? And all I thought about was, you know, like, responsibility, and you gotta be this, and you gotta do that, and you gotta be this, and fear, and fear, and fear, and fear. When I read that in the book, We Live in 100 Forms of Fear, I probably lived in about 1,000 of them. I couldn't count how much fear I lived in. You know? I was so afraid of life that, you know, like, I didn't even know what it was like to even be me. You know? Needless to say, my alcoholism got so bad that she wound up divorcing me, and I wound up on the street. And the crazy thing about it is, too, is like she divorced me, and people say, did you feel bad about her divorcing you? And I had to be honest with them, and I said, no. I was happy she was gone, because now I don't have to be responsible for her anymore. You know, that's how nuts we are. I don't have to be responsible for her or this child anymore. I can go out and do what I want to do to get what I need to get so that I can feel okay. That's all I cared about. It was a 24-hour-a-day job at that point, 7 days a week. You know, I couldn't get up in the morning without reaching under the bed and having a bottle under there. And then a little box with my sedatives in it. You know, and getting what I had to get every day was the job in itself. And, you know, they put a padlock on my house, and the sheriff took my home, and they took my car, and, you know, I couldn't get a job, and, you know, I started making it in and out of the hospitals at this time, and, you know, I would go in, I'd clean up, I'd come out. You know, 30 days here, 6 months here. I spent 9.5 months in a treatment facility. And 21 days in a detox. And the day I walked out of that 9.5 month program, I was waiting across the street with the graduation thing in my back pocket. And I'm standing there with a duffel bag, and I really don't have anywhere to go. I had burned pretty much every bridge in my, everybody in my world that had wanted nothing to do with me. And, I'm standing there trying to figure out where I'm going to go. And the bus stop was in front of a bar. Okay. Now you think 9.5 months of these people telling me, you got to stay away from bars. You got to stay away from this one. You got to stay away from your old friends. You got to stay away from this. You can't live here. You can't live there. You know, and it's like, what am I supposed to do? You know, like, move somewhere, to be protected, you know? I mean, I had nowhere to go. I didn't know anything else. You know, my neighborhood had a bar on every corner. What was I supposed to do? I had no clue. They taught me how to make a bed nice, you know? They taught me, you know, really, they taught me how to wash dishes, okay, you know, things like that. But they really didn't teach me how to live. How to live life on life's terms, you know? And this is like 1978, 79, somewhere around there, you know? And they told me I had to go to AA meetings, too. And AA wasn't like this, it is now. There weren't a lot of groups around doing 12-step work and doing big book work and stuff. You were going to a big book meeting back in the 70s, and the book would be here, displayed on the table in front of the meeting, okay? But a big book meeting consisted of reading a story out of the back, and everybody telling you how good and bad their day was. That's what it was. It was a giant therapy session. And if you just didn't drink, and you made it through the day, you're a winner. Okay? And if anybody knows, that totally contradicts the first step. But I didn't know that at the time. I'm thinking that these guys with time are going to guide me and help me, and I'm going to listen to them because I'm tired of living the way I'm living. And, you know, like, I guess their heart was in the right place, but what they were selling me wasn't working for me. You know, and for 3 years I did that. And near the end, I was living in a car on the night, about 2 blocks away from where I took my first drink. Okay. I would smell my clothes that were in the trunk, because I didn't have many of them, to see which ones didn't smell worse than the other ones. I mean, I stopped wearing underwear because the underwear was so bad that, you know, like the cats would follow and dogs would follow me down the street, you know? Seriously. When I got bathed, I would bathe under the fire hydrant in the neighborhood. You know? And I often wonder, like, how far down the scale am I going to have to go before I actually start to wise up? You know? This shit's like, it's killing me. You know? And 3 years of don't drink, make a meeting, tape a dime to your chip. That was a good one. You know, they used to have pay phones back then. They didn't have cell phones. So they used to tell you, tape a dime to your chip. And if you feel like drinking, call somebody. Yeah, okay. I might drink, then call you because I'm going to sit there and cry to you about why I drank. Okay? I'm not calling nobody, oh, yeah, I feel like drinking right now. No. If I'm in that much pain, I'm drinking. Okay? It's the only thing I knew that would take me out of my pain. It's the only solution I had to my problem, which really I never knew was living. I had a living problem. I just didn't know how to live life on life's terms. I was afraid of responsibility. I had no courage in my world. Excuse me. Okay? I couldn't tell the truth if my life depended on it. I lied so much that I believed my own lies. Seriously. If you could have told me I was the king of Siam, I would have believed it. Where's my camel park? You know? I was sitting on a corner about 6 o'clock one night. Now I'm disheveled. I smell. I'm dirty. I'm depressed, you know. I don't even have anything to even try and kill myself. I like wanted to walk in front of a train or walk in front of a car or whatever, but I didn't want to cause the problem to the person that was going to hit me or damage their vehicle, you know. Like, and I look up and there's this friend of mine walking down the street, and he's got a bop to his step, and he's got his head up, and last time I saw this guy was a couple years before, and he was barricaded in his house, and the Philadelphia SWAT unit was around his house, and he was threatening to kill his dog, and his mother, okay? And he was probably about 130 pounds, and he was gray. And he was so nuts that I didn't even want to go near him. But he's walking down the street, and his head's high, and he's got this big smile on his face and all this stuff. And he turned around, and he seen me, and he sat down with me. He said, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm not doing too good. You know," I said, "I've been going to this place here, and, you know, I'm trying what they're trying to do, and it's just not working." I said, "I can't just stop drinking, and I can't stop doing the other things I'm doing, and my life is shit, you know." And I said, "I don't know what to do." He says, "Come with me tonight. I want to pick you up here at 7 o'clock. He said, "I want you to meet some people." And I said, "Well, who am I meeting?" He says, "Well, I got this friend of mine, Andy, and these few guys." And I had heard about this guy, Andy. He ran a cult. He's carried that blue book around with him under his arm, okay? And he would have a cup of coffee in his hand, and as soon as he seen you walk in the room, he would attack you. And he would start feeding you this bullshit, and, you know, if you bought it, he'd have you drinking the Kool-Aid real fast. This is what everybody in AA was telling me about this guy. I was scared to death of him. I didn't want to go near this guy, you know? But I didn't care at this point. I didn't care if I had to sell flowers on Roosevelt Boulevard or join the Unification Church or pray to Sun Mung Moon. I just wanted to stop living the way I was living. And I was willing to do anything I had to do to get it, okay? And he takes me to meet this guy, and everything that everybody told me about him was true. As soon as I walked down the steps of this church and walked into this room, he spotted me. He got up. It seemed like an automatically a cup of coffee appeared in his hand. You know, like in a coffee, you know. And he had that blue book under his arm, and he's coming towards me. And I'm saying to myself, this is the guy they're talking to me about. He's got a $14 wardrobe on. He had a pair of $3 sneakers, Wranglers that he looked like he just took out of the waste paper, the hamper. You know, had this like mattress plaid shirt on. He was real skinny, and he had an Adam's apple that stuck out about this far. Now here you go, I'm living in a car, eating out of dumpsters, and I'm worried about what this guy's wearing. That's how screwed up we are. I'm taking his inventory as he's coming down the aisle. And he came up to me, he introduced himself to me, he gave me a cup of coffee, and he sat me down, and he started to explain to me alcoholism. Okay? And he said, "Let me ask you a question. How many places have you been in so far?" And I've been to quite a number. I said, "A lot." He says, "How many times have you been removed from alcohol and the other things you're doing?" I said, "Quite a lot." He said, "What's the first thing you think about when you walk out them doors of them treatment centers and them facilities?" And I turned around and I said, "Well, I don't want to go back out into the world. Every time I walk through them double doors, whatever I have with me, this overwhelming fear would come about me. I was scared to death to walk back into the world because I knew what was going to happen. I already knew that I wasn't going to stay clean long, okay? Because the world and everything in it scared the shit out of me. And I actually knew that, you know?" He said, "Okay." He says, "Well, how do we stop living in fear?" He said, "And they're telling you you have to give up your solution to the way you deal with these things." I never really heard it put that way. I have to give up the solution that I found to help me deal with fear, which is alcohol and the other things that I was doing. I said, "I really don't know." He said, "Here," he says, "I got a gift for you." He said, he gave me a big book, gave me my first big book. He said, here, I want you to take this home with you and I want you to read it. He said, my number's in the back. He says, and if you want help, he said, I have a solution to your problem. And that's exactly the way he put it. I have a solution to your problem. Nobody else had told me to have a solution to my problem. Everybody had an idea of what I was supposed to do that I couldn't do. Okay? Because I had no clue that I was powerless over whether I picked up a drink or I didn't pick up a drink. Because I had this thing called alcoholism. Okay? I had that obsession of the mind. I obsessed over it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There wasn't enough of it on the face of the earth to get me to where I needed to be, to shut that freight train off in my head. Okay? To get rid of the guilt, remorse, and shame of all the things that I had done for all that time. Okay? And that's only the things that people knew about. That's not talking about the secrets down in my soul. Okay? All the dishonesties and the crooked stuff and, you know, not living the right way, living in God's world and I'm living in Frank's world. I was a selfish person. And I didn't care what I did to do what I had to do. You know? And I, after I read all this stuff to him, and I went back and I talked to him, I said, well, how am I supposed to live the right way? He said, well, we have steps for that. He said, but you gotta get a sponsor. And I didn't buy it at first. You know, I thought it was too simple. I really did. I thought it was too easy. I mean, I had seen 20 doctors. Each one of them had a different diagnosis for me. I had been on medication. And I had been abstinent. I had locked myself away for months, scared to death to go outside. But the best one was when I went to my parish priest and told him I was possessed by demons, okay, and that I needed an exorcism, okay. But the crazy thing is everybody that I've ever talked to that had God in their world all had the same answer to me. You know? There's nothing wrong. You don't have demons, he says. What you have is an absence of God in your world. Every single one of them. My parish priest told me that. He says, why don't you sit here and pray with me? And I went, yeah, no thanks. You know, God put me in this position for being a bad kid, you know, all this time. He says, no, he didn't. He says, you put yourself in that position. He says, God will help you get out of it if you let him. Now I'm starting to hear about God, and I'm starting to hear about spirituality, and I'm starting to hear about all this soul cleansing stuff and all that. I don't have the guts to do any of this. If I could have done any of this stuff, I would have done it a long time ago and been rid of it. You know? Well, Andy finally turned around and he said to me, he says, look, he says, it's what this thing is designed to do. Okay? It's designed to help you find a power greater than yourself that will help solve your problem. I said, well, yeah, it's going to help me stop drinking. He says, nah, he says, that's not your problem. Alcohol's your solution to your problems. He said, you got a living problem, son. He said, you don't know how to deal with life on life's terms. He said, you're the most selfish, self-centered person that walks the face of the earth. Okay? And when you don't get what you want, you know, what happens? You take your bowl and you go home. You cry in your milk. You got self-pity. You know, you got all this fear about you. He says, the only thing you know how to deal with the world is a drink. He said, but this stopped working a long time ago. You've been chasing a dream. He said, do me a favor, he said. Listen to what I tell you to do and do it. He said, if you don't like what I'm telling you to do, your misery's out there. It's waiting for you. He says, guaranteed. Okay? He said, but what I'm offering you is a chance at life to be happy, joyous, and free. Okay? He said, but, he said, you got to listen to what I tell you. And He wasn't easy on me. He was very hard on me. He used to tell me all the time that I had a problem with my listener. And I didn't understand what he meant. I used to tell him, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. He says, you might hear what I'm saying, but you're not listening to me. You're not listening to what I'm telling you. Okay? 40 years later, and I still hear the stuff that this man said to me when things arise in my world today. That's how prolific his guidance was, you know. And he took me on his shoulders, and he carried me, and he helped me. I chased him with a chair one night because I didn't like something that he said to me. I hear him knocking on the window of the car that I'm sleeping in. The next morning he goes, come on, wake up. He says, we're going to go get breakfast. I said, what are you, nuts? I said, I almost hit you with a chair yesterday. He went, oh, it was yesterday. He said, this is a different day. And that's how he lived. He lived one day at a time, one moment at a time. You know, he never celebrated anniversaries and, you know, like, or nothing like that. He said, all you got is today, contingent upon how you live your life and how you live in God's world. He says, don't ever take credit for this. He says, because it's not yours to take credit for. Okay? And I also understood what he meant by that. I was sober 21 years and relapsed. Okay? Because the first thing he told me when he started taking me through this 12-step process was, if you're not willing to make this the most important thing in your life, your old life is there. He said, it's waiting for you. He said, it'll be there waiting for you. You know? He said, it might not be the same way as it was. He said, but when we're in pain, he says, we fall back to the only thing we know that makes us well. Okay? And I didn't think I had to be around here anymore. I didn't think I had to help people anymore. I didn't think that I had to sit with newcomers anymore. I didn't think I had to pray every day or keep my house clean and all that stuff. And bottom line was is that I hadn't been around Alcoholics Anonymous or helped anybody or prayed or anything in 4 years before I picked up. Okay? And fortunately, God seemed deemed fit to me get me back here. I knew that whatever happened worked. You know, it got me to a point where I was willing to come back. And he was in Vegas, and I called him, and I said, listen, I said, this is what happened. He said, well, he says, I told you. He used to love telling, I told you, you know, didn't I? I got another guy to help me through the work again. And you know, the funny thing about it is that making this the most important thing in your life thing never leaves my mind. Okay. You know, when Abby Thatcher sat down with Bill and Bill asked him, how are you the way you are? And he said, I found religion. I live my program religiously. Not because of the fear that if I don't do it, I'm going to wind up going back out there. But I found that God has given me a gift to be of service to other people. And I love helping people today. And I don't do it because it keeps me immune from another drink and all this stuff. Because I have God in my world today that does that for me. Okay? For me to go around and chase newcomers to make me get a good feeling is selfish. I help people because I want to help them, okay? I don't help people because I want a reward out of it. God gives me all the rewards I need, okay? I have a wonderful relationship with a God of my understanding that provides what I need as long as I keep close to Him and perform His work well. I don't have $1 million, okay? I probably got every single solitary insane thing that happens to somebody in the normal world happens to them, you know. I got troubles just like everybody else. I got life circumstances just like everybody else, you know. And that's okay. Okay? All I know is I got up this morning and I asked God, how can I be of service to you today? Let me do your will. Alright? And I trust that, because He has never let me down. Okay? Tonight when I go home, I'll do my inventory and I'll see how screwed up I was today. You know, and not only in action, but in thought. See, people think it has to be action. It's not about action, it's about my thoughts. How do I keep my house clean? How do I keep my soul filled? Okay? By getting rid of all this crap. Did I hurt anybody today? Did I have to do amends? And you know, it's like I said, Shay called me yesterday and said, would you like to speak your feet first? I said, who canceled? Because that's what I usually get. I usually get, I had somebody call me one time in New York. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon for an 8 o'clock meeting. I live in South Philadelphia. It's a 2 hour ride. And I'm still working. I said, yeah, sure, I'll come up. I said, but I'm coming in my work clothes. You know? And I drove up there and I was able to be of service, you know. But the best thing about this thing is today is that I will go home tonight. I will say my nightly prayers. I will do what I have to do and I'll hit that pillow and I'll go to sleep. I'll go to sleep with a clear conscience, knowing that I didn't hurt nobody today, that I didn't, you know, cause any ill wills in this world today. You know, that I actually lived like a human being today. And I can't take any credit for that. You know? That's all God given. That's all a result of taking these 12 steps. Okay? And living the way that this program has taught me to live. You know? And, anybody can do it if they're sick and tired of living the way they're living. You know, so, if you're hurting, if you're having problems, if life ain't treating you well, and you constantly think about a drink or whatever, and, you know, you find yourself finding other ways to get out of yourself, you know, do yourself a favor. Maybe you should ask somebody to help you live this way of life, and, be free of all that, and, it works if you let it. So thanks for having me. Thank you.